I want to talk about, I guess, what solidarity can mean. I think that, I'll just speak briefly. I worked for many years for an organization in Toronto called the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. And during that time, I imagine a lot of people know of that organization. It's one that is known to be very forthright, militant, at times aggressive, very action-based, and that takes on very basic level injustices, whether it's around housing and homelessness, whether it's around the kinds of situations that Sarita has just described. And I worked there for a long time, and it was actually through OCAP that I met my partner, who is Mohawk from Tainanaga. Mohawk's the Bay of Quinte, which is about, well, pretty exactly 4 hours west of here. The 401 actually cuts through the northern tip of the reserve. And as a result of meeting him, I began to spend a lot of time in that community, which is also a very, very, I mean, it's a very strong community. It's very well organized. It both defends its territory, rights, resources, et cetera, as well as asserts itself in those same areas. And I guess I see it as a great honor and privilege that I have been given to be able to witness and participate in a lot of the struggles that are ongoing within the community of Tainanaga and within the Mohawk Nation. And it was an interesting thing that it kind of put two perspectives, one that I garnered from the work in the city and then the second from the reserve, together. Because I think that there is a tremendous difference in the way that resistance is organized in cities vis-a-vis in Native communities. And I witnessed, I mean, it was a funny thing because within Tainanaga, as I say, it's a very strong community, and actually mandated folks to go forth probably, well, over 10 years ago now, outside of the community to develop those links with others in struggle, specifically. You know, not necessarily the same struggles, not necessarily groups that were formed as solidarity organizations, but organizations that were confronting the government, confronting the state on their own issues. And the recognition there that I think is very often lost on at the outset when we talk about solidarity is that we can be in solidarity in that context. It may be that the issues are specifically different, the actions are specifically different, but that there is an understanding and a mutual respect for the struggles that occur, and that alone can be solidarity. That fighting your own fights, that dealing with the injustices within the communities in Montreal, within the Latino community, as Sarita's just talking about, that taking those on in ways that are serious, that are uncompromising, can and are very much in solidarity with the same struggles that are occurring on Indian lands, within Indian territories, on reservation. So I want to just say that at the outset, because I think that point is very often missed, and I think that when that happens, we lose a part of what the solidarity is all about. The second thing that I want to also say about solidarity, and it goes back to what I was just talking about in terms of how differently things are organized. You know, in Toronto, in OCAP, some of us will know better than others how it's organized there, but it's kind of like the organization, in many respects, becomes the identifying factor in one's life. You know, very often, commitment to a given struggle is assessed based on the number of meetings one might attend, right? And that is, to my mind, is not quite right, but it's also totally different from how things happen that I've witnessed and I've experienced in Indian communities, and most specifically in Tainanaga, which is what I can talk about. And that is that life, you know, goes on. There's a cohesion, there's an understanding of cohesion based on the nation, based on the community, based on the shared history and the struggle that has gone on, you know, for centuries. But it's kind of like, it's the difference between organizing an event, planning it for 2, 4, 6 months ahead of time, having the posters put out, you know, making sure all the emails are done, versus there is an issue. There is an incursion on the sovereignty of the territory. There is, RCMP coming through and just parking on the roads. There is an attempt by the OPP to take over the reservation police force. There is a lack of housing. These issues come up, and there is no series of meetings where, you know, you map out your poster and this and that, and the issues come up and people are organized in such a way as to address them, as to deal with them when they do come up. And to me, that is a level of organization that communities in the city should be striving for. It's the ability to respond when you need to. It's the ability to assert yourself when you need to. So that, for instance, in 1997, Tainanega, I guess to 92. In 92, Tainanega reasserted for the first time in 80 years the practice of fishing off the reserve. There's territorial waters all around the reserve where pickerel fish swim. And for the better part of the 20th century, people had been, you know, forced back onto the reserve itself, so that the only river, the one river in the bay that people were fished, were on the reserve and didn't venture off into the territorial waters that ran largely off reserve. In 92, that was taken back by the community. There was a situation where 400 people of the community lined the banks of the Belleville River and squared off against 1,000 non-native people from surrounding areas. And I imagine I'm setting the scene enough so that you know that they're not happy about it, right? I mean, these are intolerant, redneck people. Thank you. and the Belleville City Police basically cordoned off the downtown core, said this is way too much for us to handle. Whoever's left standing at the end of the day wins the day, and either you fish or you don't. And ever since that year, every year, probably close to 1,000 men and women from Tainanega fish these rivers. So when in 1997 there was a couple of young guys went to Consicon, which is sort of south west of the reserve and is really kind of the heart of the assholes, they were met with it's kind of like there's like a pool of water that's, I guess, man-made or whatever, human intervention, so that it forms a pool right below a bar. There's like a balcony overhang. Anyway, so these young guys, like 15, 16, are in this river, and very shortly afterwards become the subject of, observation, racial slurs, beer bottles flying, very quick to follow by all of these patrons in this bar. And so when that, you know, that word travels throughout the community, you can well imagine that travels pretty darn quick. And literally the next night, and this was the right when I first, you know, spent any time there at all, it was like the following night there was a convoy of, I don't know, 30, 40 cars went up to that same small town. The three boys who had borne the brunt of the intolerance the few nights before went back to the river. The bar is open. And everyone else waited behind, about 10 minutes behind. Just, you know, so that people could start to feel however they're feeling. And so they start fishing again, and then everyone comes up, you know, up and around and beyond. And I mean, it was a funny kind of situation because there's no press release, there's no poster, there's no speeches, there's no placards. But I can tell you that for that unsavory element in the town of Consecon, what was going on was, like, without question, intimately clear to them. And it was a very, very short time before the local police came and suggested that for the, you know, the bar's own safety, that they shut up, like shut down for the night. And that's what happened. And then it was great because there's a very much like a social, the whole fishing thing is, it's important to the fabric of the community in many ways, economically, you know, providing food, but it's also like a social occasion, you know, like people all go out on the rivers, you know, like you fish at night because the fish don't like the light, so you have to wait till it's dark and people light fires and they cook the fish and, it, you know, whole families come out and you see like 4-year-old kids with these like, you know, gigantic fish that they're hauling back to the trucks and stuff like that, and it's a really nice thing in that way, and so at that point, like that whole sort of social atmosphere was allowed to emerge, and people were relaxed, and the younger kids got suited up and went into the water as well. But I use that just as an illustration of that ability to, you know, respond when it's needed, you know, in an instant. And I think that's really important. And when I bring it back to here, to all of yous and to the IPSM and to groups of people who are, you know, socially conscious and wanting to, you know, we're talking about a decolonization movement. And to me, that's really interesting and that's really heartening. But I think that these kinds of things need to be, I guess, taken in. Because the kind of organizing that we might do in other sectors or other quarters is not going to work the same way. And a lot of it I see, it was funny, I was listening to Arnie last night and he was talking about the potential volatility in situations and how, you know, a lot of times we don't even hear about it when there's arms at a certain standoff or there's, you know, that volatility really is kept out of the public eye a lot of times. But that doesn't mean that it's not there. I find it a funny kind of situation because you have a lot, I think, within anti-globalization and anarchist movements and like the action-based organizations or affiliations, however it comes to be, out of that, there is, an interesting, I see it as an interesting and sometimes kind of bizarre relationship with the question of force and the question of violence. And I think sometimes it gets a little bit, it almost seems to me that games start to be played. And I think that the thing about within Indian communities who have faced down so much aggression, you know, artillery, guns, everything from the state, that it's a different kind of understanding. And it brings to my mind what Jacques Chagnon said about Gansadage last year when things were very hot and heated there, and he was talking about the confrontational inherent nature of Mohawks to be more confrontational than normal people, and that, you know, they're liable if a pigeon flies over to shoot it down. Which, you know, I mean, there's obviously like volumes that can be said about that statement, but I think that the real thing is that it's not that there's a tendency to violence. There's no tendency to violence. Nobody wants that situation. Nobody, I remember when my partner was in Gansadage, and it was a situation where there was, you know, a real strong belief and for very good reason that they were going to be sending in the army again. And, you know, coming home and the lights flashing on the phone, and I pick up the phone, like I check the messages, and he's on the phone going, you know, well, it looks like they're going to come in. I want to say I love you, love the kids, my mom and dad. And you get those messages, and it's not fun, and it's not games, you know? But there is a willingness within Indigenous communities to stand those lines, you know, when it's needed, that there are people, like Arnie said last night, we try the peaceful route, we will try the peaceful route, but it may not always be the option, you know?